It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and today we are back with the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling, episode 18. I'm not in Manchester. I'm back in Brig. I'm back on my own computer, my normal computer that I normally work with, which means it's predictable and nice and does nice things. And we're back on Skype with Miss Chelsea Spolin. How are you, Mom?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right. Did you like the fact we saved you from watching more Hulk Hogan matches by not including you last week?
Yes, that was good. That was a good call.
But I did find you something you enjoyed quite a lot instead, didn't I?
You did! This was awesome.
Okay, we're looking at All Japan Women today in 1991. Now, the match we're going to look at is a bit of an interesting one. I'd seen it before. I'd found it on YouTube and thought this was really, really cool. And then I kind of forgot about it because I watched it a couple of years ago. And then I was looking for cards to do with this one. And I was looking for the big names in 1991 in AJW. And there wasn't a lot about. And then I found this video. And it was listed as from Currican Hall. And the date was on the 29th of April, 1991. It's not from Currican Hall, as I was corrected, because I live tweet these things whilst I watch them. And as I sent a picture out of what I was looking at, and said, you know, All Japan Women did a really good job of like making Currican Hall look massive. And then a guy whose name I'm just going to find sent me a tweet back saying, that's not Currican Hall. He said it's a skate arena, and I'm just where
your
are
followers are on their shit, James.
Yeah, he was didn't even follow me, he just found it. So is a guy called at Chase Kills, and he's told me it was at Amir Skate Center, a card from spring of 1991. But you're right, he was right, because the crowd was too big for Currican Hall, but it had a similar layout to Currican Hall, and the parquet flooring was the same. That's what confused me. But also, it's listed on the video as from Currican Hall, and it's also listed on Cage Match as from Currican Hall, but it's not. So
I thought it was until you just told me that it wasn't.
It's a bit strange, but there you go. This card was a bit of an interesting transition time for All Japan Women. We've just come out of the Crush Girls era, and we have a new champion and a new ace of the company. So things are growing in a different direction. And this was before the big matches of the 1990s and the big cross-promotional matches. So they weren't quite yet giving names to cards. In fact, through 1991, the only named card they had was WrestleMarimpiad, which was their kind of WrestleMania. Chelsea, what was your overall impressions of this card? And where do you think All Japan were placed in 1991?
Oh, my God. So my overall impression is that this show was nuts. Like, it was... There is so much great wrestling in this show. And there are so many different weird, eclectic things that happen in this show that I wasn't totally expecting. You asked where AJW was placed. Like, do you mean in terms of the wrestling quality, or do you mean like how the fans felt about it? Like, what are we talking about?
I'm thinking about like where the company was kind of like creatively. Financially, it was doing well, but creatively, where do you think the company was? Could you still tell this is kind of a hangover from the Crush Girls era, or were new things starting to happen?
I think new things were starting to happen, but I don't know if the people who were running the company had fully gotten on board with all of it yet, because it feels like there's a little bit of that tension there where the wrestlers have figured out the direction that they want to take themselves in and their matches in, but they're not necessarily doing it with the full backing of the institution, if that makes sense.
There's a bit of tension there.
Yes, you can tell.
Okay, then. So the card is called All Japan at Currican Hall, if you want to find it at various places. Again, I think that we found it on the Real Hero Archive. You can find that on by searching the internet. I'm sure you'll find it somewhere. And again, because AJW shut down years ago, no one's going to be too bothered about the rights to this. There's All Japan's women's stuff everywhere. Now, like I said, it was on the 29th of April, 1991, and it opened with a six-man tag, which featured Keio Ito, Kazuyo Saito, Mayumi Yamamoto versus two people we can't find a name for, and Tomoko Watanabe. The two people we can't name the name for probably didn't last that long in the All Japan Women Dojo. I think they were the girls in the denim jackets, like teeny bopper kind of style people, weren't they?
Yeah, just like generic baby faces.
Yeah. And this was, as per usual, a hell for leather All Japan Women Rookies match. What did you think, Chelsea?
I wrote in my notes everything in the kitchen sink. It's a high energy match. There's a good flow and everybody is so good. It's kind of crazy that some of them aren't more famous.
Yeah.
Like I was Googling people in this match. I'm like, why have I never heard of this person? It's weird because they're running around in bathing suits, but they wrestle like they're very, very serious. They take this all very seriously. It's all very kinetic. It's meant to look like it hurts when they sell for things, but they're not presented with that level of seriousness.
No, this is supposed to be a bit of fun, isn't it? And if you look at Tomoka Watanabe, he's kind of the only one who's really taking things really deadly seriously.
Yes.
Noticeably, she's still active in pro wrestling at the age of... Oh, yeah, she's 45 and has now Amazing. Been wrestling for 27 years.
Amazing.
Yes, she wrestles for Marvelous, Chigusou Nagai's company.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and she back then she was wearing gi pants and a swimsuit, so it was kind of like this halfway standard MMA-style crossover thing going on with her, and she kicked really hard. That was her thing.
She's
much more of a technica these days. But she certainly stood out for me, and the crowd popped for her as well. She was thinking she'd probably have a little bit more experience than the others.
They loved her. Like she when she got in the ring, the crowd volume doubled. So you could tell she was really, really popular.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, really. You know, the result of that particular match was Watanabe's crew defeated Ito's crew, basically, in 8 minutes and 1 second. And it kind of like because there was no build to finishes, because it's a rookies match and they don't really have finishes, it was kind of petered out towards the end. But it was still an interesting watch, and the pace they're going at to try and prove themselves as well.
Yeah. It's, again, the wrestlers clearly take it very seriously. It's real serious business. It's not totally unlike watching a New Japan Young Lions match when they have a new young lion who they've let in the ring for the first time in front of a TV crowd. I felt a little bad for them, frankly, that there wasn't more of a finish at the end of it, but I knew that that was just the format.
Yeah, yeah. It's just kind of way introduce people gently rather than, you know, force feeding them a story that they might have trouble living up to. So, it works well. Okay, then. Next was a tag match, which featured Mika Takahashi, Miyori Kamiya, and they defeated Los Cocajares Orientales at Tsukamita and Mima Shimoda. Well, Los Cocajares Orientales didn't really exist at this particular time, but Mita and Shimoda were queen heels. We talked in the last All Japan segment we did when we looked at Pro Wrestling Grand Prix 1990, when Mita and Shimoda had broken away from Toshiya Yamada and Manami Toyota, and now they started to tag team together, and they were born heels. They were badasses, despite the fact that All Japan Women seemed to insist on dressing them as a pair of space cadets.
I wrote, why is she dressed like a futuristic flight attendant?
Yeah, it was their outfit choices were somewhat strange. And Takahashi and Kamiya did not become big names in All Japan Women. Mita and Shimoda did. So this was possibly a misstep in the booking of All Japan Women, to be fair. But the match was really, really good. And Mita and Shimoda are just a cracking tag team. What do you think of these two?
This is, again, another one of those things where I was, like, Googling people going, why don't I know who that person is already? Or, you know, I've heard that name. It sounds familiar, but there's no information about them on the internet. Like, it's shocking to me how many people at this time were so good and just got forgotten about. Because there were so many big names in this period that they get kind of lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
This match is really good. It's not quite as exciting as some of the stuff that follows, but I enjoyed it. It's exciting because everybody in it performs at a really high technical level. A lot of the stuff in this match looks like a genuine fight in ways that I feel like are not popular in Joshi now, and maybe they're not as popular in Joshi now post, what is the name of that girl in Stardom who got fired? Yeah. I feel like Joshi has moved a little bit away from everything has to look like a stiff, realistic fight, and, you know, moving more towards, like, let's use crazy acrobatics to, and other elements of storytelling to tell the story of this competition. A lot of the bumps that the girls take in this match, I was like, ooh, that looks kind of rough. Yeah. Also, I wrote in my notes and I wanted to mention it. Mika Takahashi has the slickest looking bridge I think I've ever seen. Yeah. Like, she just goes into it at one point, like, flawlessly. And I was shocked because I didn't really know that much about her.
Yeah, me neither, really. She's another one of these, like, women that didn't make the cut because the standard was just so ridiculously high.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, of all the people we've talked about today, only one of them is still active. Old Kiyoru Ito is still active, and Kamiya is still active. But, you know, mm-hmm. Ito isn't as big a name as Watanabe, and Kamiya definitely isn't as big a name as Watanabe. And Mita and Oshimoda is still active, and is still a relatively big name and a big draw. Mita would be, if she didn't injure herself into retirement. But, yeah. You know, just like, out of these 10 people you talk about in the first two matches, they're all really, 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 really good.
But they're just astonishing.
But only two of them had headlining careers.
That's bizarre.
And Mita and Shimoda are arguably the best women's tag team ever. You know? they were that good. You had to be, like, seriously the best in your field to be able to just stick around, never mind, like, you know, do anything.
Which, can I ask, because we've talked about this a couple of times, like, this particular thing about how people get to be, how people get to be, like, drowned out by the big names at the time. But how is it possible that there was so, so, so much quality at one time? Is it just the level of the training?
I think it's a mixture of things. I mean, up until this point, well, maybe the year before, you got JWP started the year before, but they weren't really competition yet. They mm-hmm. hadn't had a first dojo and produced their stars. So they've got a lock on the talent pool. Because you've got that 26 rule, you're always filtering the top end out, so you need to fill the bottom end up.
Right.
From practical point of view, whether it's right or wrong, we've had that discussion before, but that's what happens. So you're always getting a new class every year. You're picking the very best of that class, and when you've just had a big boom period like the Crush Girls period, more women want to be wrestlers, so you get a bigger pool of talent of which you can pick the best, and then through the dojo you can weed out to get the absolute very, very best.
So, that makes sense.
So it really kind of, like, this revolution certainly did start in 1968. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't an early 90s phenomenon. This has taken 22 years to get to this point. And I think once you've got them there, then it's the pressure cooker of you're in the most creative professional wrestling company in the world.
Right.
And you don't want to lose your job. So you have to try that much harder than everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily the best business practice in the world, you know. And certainly, I would argue that the Yoshiko incident was probably a direct result of this. That kind of alpha personality in a dressing room, and believing she could get away with murder because of the relationship she had with the senior members of the company.
Right.
You know, which is the way All Japan worked. If you were a leader in the locker room in All Japan, the rookies did what you said. Everything you said. And that wasn't necessarily the best thing for relationships. It wasn't necessarily the most professional thing that could happen.
And right.
Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So it doesn't, you know, this is not, as much as I love All Japan Women's product as a company, it has its faults as far as a social order is concerned and as far as business practice is concerned. It's not necessarily the nicest way to treat people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that makes sense.
You know, and that's the thing about wrestling, though. Though we love it, you know, there are things I completely disagree with about wrestling as well. You know, and this is one of these things that I have to struggle with as a fan of wrestling. This is incredibly artistic, creative. It is wonderful. And you can see in certain wrestlers the absolute joy they have in the ring.
Yeah.
But for that 20 minutes of the day, what's the rest of the other 24 hours of the 23 hours and 40 minutes of their lives like?
And, you know, for some of these girls, like, their careers are only, like, 5 years, 6 years, 9 years. What toll did it take on them physically to do all these things that they then had to deal with for the rest of their lives?
Yeah. This is the real cruelness about All Japan women. You know, you had people that were only top stars for 4 or 5 years. And then you had people like Manami Toyota who've been stars for 30 years. So it's a lot of it is luck of the draw. Just absolute luck of the draw. One bad bump and you're done. Whereas other people had incredibly risky things that they did, but they're fine. And it's cruel, but what can you do? You know, and certainly I think current Joshi practice is a lot healthier than this used to be.
Yeah.
Certainly. And things are nowhere near as tight as they used to be. And people kind of look after themselves a lot more. And I think it's a lot healthier. And you have a lot of happier wrestlers, certainly, which is a reason.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people seem to enjoy about some of the top baby faces. You know, like I think of Kairi, or I think of the girl from Ice Ribbon, Tsukasa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think of one of the things that people really connect to about them is their palpable joy that you don't really see that much of that in this card.
No, this is dead serious. This is competition, whether it is predetermined or not. You know, you can tell in that match with Mita and Shimoda, they're pissed.
Yeah.
And they're probably pissed because they got booked to lose.
Yeah.
You know, and they were not nice to the people they were wrestling in any way, shape, or form. But that stems the breaks.
Yeah.
This is big boy stuff, really. You know, I hate the phrase is incorrect, but you know what I mean? This is as pressure cooker as pro wrestling politics gets.
Shit just got real.
Yeah. Right then, we'll move on to the standard WWA Martial Arts title match, and Bachi Shinga continues to rule with an iron fist. She fights the absolutely poor girl that is Akima Tarisu, who got the shit kicked out of her. There is no other way to describe it. Her nose was shattered into 1,000 pieces after the first round. There was blood everywhere, to the point where Yushinga's white t-shirt was dyed red. This was not good to watch. It was not healthy. It was not healthy for Tarisu. What did you think?
So I googled Akemi Torisu, and the only other fight I could find that she had was an MMA loss in 2001. She tries really hard, but I just don't think this is her calling, or maybe she just wasn't experienced enough yet. This is really, really violent, and it's repetitive enough that it's kind of boring, but you feel bad for being bored because there's blood all over everybody.
Yeah.
And you want to show respect to their effort, but it's a murder. Like, yeah. It's not fun to watch. It's a squash.
Yeah, it's a squash, but it's a shoot fight, so it's a painful squash. And
yes.
Yushinga kind of, like, didn't put her away when she should have done. If she'd, like, the ref, to be honest, in the third, was it the third or the fourth round where Tarisu gets knocked down 5 times? They should have called it then, really.
Yeah.
She clearly couldn't defend herself. The fact that she kept standing up was a miracle. And, you know, and it was the same problem of you can't lead with haymakers for 5 rounds and expect to get anywhere when you've got no guard. Yeah. I'm no MMA expert, but I think that's pretty much what it was.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. So we'll move on to a wrestling match, which was actually very, very good. This was Mariko Yoshida, Seki Hasegawa, and Toshiya Yamada, and they defeated Cynthia Marino, Debbie Malenko, and Yumiki Ohota. This was brilliant. I love this match, and the inter-rivalries between the wrestlers was fantastic, especially Yamada and Hotta. There's two premier kickers, and the crowd was so hot for watching them two get together. This was mid-card filler, but it was very, very good mid-card filler. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is f***ing great. Like, I'm sorry that you're going to have to bleep that, but this is awesome. Like, I was not totally sure when they did the little interview segments before this what was going to happen because it was very stiff. But I was looking at the wrestlers in it. I'm like, well, Toshio Yamada, Yumika Hata, like some good's going to happen there. And oh, man, the crowd is so hot for Yamada and Yumika Hata. And like the volume doubles every time one or both of them is in the ring. The fans had like rhythmic chanting for whenever Yamada and Yumika Hata were in the ring together, and it makes sense. There's a power bomb that Yamada delivers to Hata, which is the craziest power bomb spot I've ever seen, where Yamada basically gets her up in the air, flips her over, like, straight up. She doesn't, like, spin out at all. Yeah. And then pulls her down to slam her. And it's freaking nuts. It looks like something out of a PWG best of highlights reel.
Yeah. It is, like, it's very, very stiff and very, very technical and very, very advanced for its time.
I wrote in my notes, the level of talent in this match could power a city.
That's a good call. I like that. Because it's like, Hot is another one who was, she was, I think she probably would have been bigger. She was a big name in this era. But she would have been bigger if it wasn't for the others around her. If Dynamite Kansai hadn't come along and Yamada hadn't come along, she would have been pretty unique in what she did. And this was like, you know, Big Hoss kickers really kicking very, very hard and very, very stiffly. You know, I slowed some of it down for pictures on Twitter, and it's like you just see like Hotter just kicking Yamada in the face. So stiff.
It's kicking, but it's not just kicking. There's a lot of technical art in this match too.
Yeah. You know, Debbie Malenko and Cynthia Marino really stand out as well.
They're both really good.
Yeah, and there is just no slack in this match. Everyone pulls their weight, and it's a lot of fun to watch, and it rollocks along, and it's stiff, and it's entertaining, and it tells a story.
Yeah.
You can't really complain with this match at all.
No, it was awesome.
Okay, then. So we'll move on to the singles match, which is next, which is Takeoko Inoue, who defeated Kyoko Inoue in 10 minutes and 1 second. This was at the time when Kyoko Inoue was the AJW champion. Now, the AJW title was not part of, was the kind of like the beginner's championship. If you were a young wrestler, this is the championship you were going for. And Kyoko Inoue was the champion at the time, but this was a non-title match. Takeoko Inoue was a technical wrestler in the mold of Manami Toyota and was incredibly good. And these two, obviously sharing the last name, were linked together throughout their careers. In fact, they formed a tag team called Double Inoue in a couple of years' time that were exceptionally good as well. And I think they ended up being the 100th WWWA tag team champions. But this match was a bit different because Takeoko Inoue was the heel, Kyoko Inoue was the face. Now, Kyoko Inoue had just come off a main event run in a supporting cast kind of character way to Bull Nakano as they took on Jungle Jack, Bison Kimura, and Aja Kong. So she was kind of coming down a level here, and they were still clearly building to something bigger. But again, this was a pretty cracking match. I'm not the biggest of Kyoko Inoue fans because I think there was better wrestlers than her. But this is still a lot of fun to watch. What did you think, Chelsea?
This was good. This was a step down from the match before it in terms of the excitement and like my excitement and the crowd's excitement. I felt like the crowd just couldn't be as hype for this.
Yeah.
It's a good match, but I like these two better as a tag team than I do as opponents. You can see the chemistry that they have. Like, they clearly get each other's timing, and there are some very, very cool transitions between moves in this match. But as opponents, you don't really have that edge that you need for two really good wrestlers to have a barn burner where you know, walk away feeling like you just had your mind blown. Like, there's some cool spots. Kyoko seems really, really sweet in the interview to begin with. And then she gets Takako in this like brutal looking submission and stomps on her knees when she kicks at her. And she's smirking the entire time. Like, the competitiveness is there. But they're almost too evenly matched for it to really feel, and not in a super exciting way. There's something that's like, that's not quite right there. There's a piece missing.
Yeah, it's not quite. Yeah, they needed some spark to make this work. And perhaps, yeah, this was maybe the thing at the time of AJW did take a couple of stabs at partnering people together to get the right kind of, how can I put it, the right kind of chemistry going. And certainly,
right,
you know, as we talked about, like the Tokyo Sweethearts were a great team, but they weren't the best pick of the bunch. You know,
right,
Dreamwalker were a great team, but weren't the best pick of the bunch. And it wasn't until you put Mita and Shimoda together and Yamada and Toyota together that you suddenly have everything that you want.
Right.
So it's interesting, really. It's interesting that the way you see this match, because I kind of agree with you. I'm not the biggest fan of Kyoko anyway, because I think there were other people who were better, but she's so over, which is a skill in itself. But it comes out to Panama by Van Halen, which always normally piques my attention because I like Van Halen. But yeah, it's still a good piece of work. It's a good match.
Also, shout out to those costumes. Like, what was going on with that weird gold Lolita prom dress thing with the figure skating costume underneath?
I don't know. Anyway, I did do some interesting things as far as dressing for wrestling matches was concerned. But at least they got Kyoko Inoue out of a hat. which is never good.
No.
She doesn't do hats well. Okay. Then we had something completely different. It was the All-Pacific, WWA All-Pacific title match, which is the white belt. For fans of World Wondering Stardom, the white belt, the Wonder of Stardom match championship is kind of, it's based on this. This is the match that's supposed to get the crowd excited and match that this is kind of like the secondary championship. And the 10th champion was Suzuka Minami, who we talked about the last time we talked about All Japan in 1990, because she won it from Aja Kong in that disqualification non-tournament match. And this was making a defense against Akira Kuto. And Kakuto wins the title in 20 minutes and 51 seconds, and the pair go on to have a really big feud where they swap the championship back and forth over the space of a year. And this was exceptional. This was a Dave Meltzer 4.5-star match. It was 20 minutes and 51 seconds. Hakuto wins, and it's just so good. It's just such a well-told story. Minami Suzuka hurts Hakuto's knee early in the match, and then Hakuto spends the rest of the match selling it. And the reason why she sells it so well is because she'd been injured that many times, she knew exactly what faces to make. Chelsea, what did you think of this match?
This is nuts. It's great, but I spent a not insignificant portion of this match wincing.
Yeah.
There's a few, I tweeted this a little while ago, so forgive me for people who follow Shoulders Up on Twitter and I'm repeating myself, but there are few constants in life, and one of them is that you need to feel sorry for whoever is going against Akira Hokuto. She's vicious, and it's artful viciousness. It's skilled viciousness, but it is just nonstop. She is the most determined person I think I've ever seen. She does not quit. And she is in legitimate pain for the entire time that she's... really the whole second half of the match, you can tell she's actually limping and that it's not just selling. And she still just gives it her all, you know? And some of the things they do to each other in this match are just nuts. I mean, like... Suzuka Minami does a crossbody off the turnbuckle onto Hokuto's leg.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen anybody do that before, but I screamed a little bit. And Hokuto, towards the latter half of the match, to put Suzuka Minami away, does jumping push-off drop kicks in succession to the face.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I mean, Hokuto cries when she wins, which is like, oh, I didn't realize you could feel feelings like that. And then, you know, Suzuka Minami has like, I mean, you know, you think of like the New Japan Pro matches now with the Young Lions giving the guys the ice pack before they're even in the back. And like they have two ice packs on her. The girls are holding her up. She doesn't look like she knows where she is. That's how intense this match is. It's great, but I also felt kind of guilty, like we were talking about before, watching it, because yikes.
Yeah. Now, Hokuto and Minami were actually tag team partners up until Minami winning the championship match. They were the Marine Wolves, and would actually be tag team partners again. and in between times, beat the shit out of one another.
That is all thoroughly unsurprising and spectacular.
Yes, it is. And yeah, they were just going at it so much. It was just so stiff. And yeah, they do look exhausted. They left it out all on the field. And, you know, and it was the classic Hokuto moment of, I've hurt my leg, pass me some tape.
Yeah.
And she tapes up her leg and she carries on, you know. Oh dear, let's move on. You know, and people give Sabu props for doing that. That's cool, but Hokuto was doing it 3 years before Sabu did it, you know. And you know, there's a certain level of recklessness to that. It's not necessarily conductive to a long career, but you know, Hokuto's career was longer than most.
She lasted a long time considering how aggressive her style was.
Yeah, you know, way longer than you'd expect it to, you know. And she also, this was another match she didn't get a finisher on, did she? Because she didn't deliver the Northern Lights bomb. She tried, but she missed.
Yeah, she couldn't. She does the, she does a bridging German, but she can't quite get herself up onto her toes because her knee is so weak.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. No, you know, normally her perfect bridge is a calling card, you know. So yeah, it's just breathlessly good. And again, Suzuki Minami was fantastic, but around at the wrong time.
Yeah.
You know, and she did amazing things. She was like a WWA Women's Tag Team Champion. She was the All Pacific Champion, you know, and she retires in 1995. She had a, you know, a fairly long career after this. And yeah, her last match is tagging with Akira Kuto against Bull Nakano and Yumiki Hotta.
Wow.
You know, so, and so she's around for a little while longer. And she was probably destined to be one of the top draws in the company, but all this hot talent came along after her. So it's kind of sad, really, that it kind of all came to a grinding halt. But
yeah,
equally, she had some great, great matches while she was around. So
Oh, also, I found out Hikari Minami.
Yeah.
From Ice Ribbon, she named herself her ring name after Suzuka Minami. She got her permission to do that.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it is. Because there's a lot of, like, you know, reverence for the wrestlers of this era. And people are really big fans of not necessarily, you know, the big two or three we talk about all the time. But, you know, Minami certainly had a fan. She was very, very popular on you know, the Twitter followers who name themselves after her and all sorts of things. Because she was a big star. But it's just... not relatively speaking. It sounds horrible, doesn't it? But she was dominant on television for a long, long time. But you look at what the other people were doing around her.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, the WWA Tag Team Championship match. As always, all WWA Tag Team Championships that were held in AJW were 2 out of 3 falls. This is 5 3/4 stars from Mr. Meltzer, and Uncle Dave was about bang on with this. Aja Kong and Bison Kimura, Jungle Jack successfully defend their championship against Esther Moreno and Minami Toyota, 2 falls to 1, in an absolutely breathtaking tag team match, made all the more breathtaking when you realize Moreno and Toyota were not regular tag team partners. They were doing this off the cuff, and they were absolutely fantastic. The first fall in 8 minutes and 11 seconds, there are no rest holds. Everything is go, go, go. They do not stop. They do not rest. No one puts on a chin lock. No one puts on a leg lock. They just fly around the ring for 8 minutes. And then they take a break when there's a fall. And then for 15 minutes, they do the same thing again. And then there's the third fall, which is 25 minutes long. This match, and it doesn't even feel like it, this match lasted well over 50 minutes. And it doesn't even, well, yeah, just around 50 minutes. And it doesn't even feel like it. You sat watching it for 50 minutes and it just flies by. I watched this match this morning and I kind of like got up, watched it, and didn't realize what the time was. It was just like quick. It just doesn't slow down. I love this wrestling match. Chelsea, what do you think?
This is insane. This is the best thing on this card, and that's saying something. It is, I wrote in my notes, one of the weirdest, coolest tag matches I've ever seen. I couldn't believe when I looked it up, what you just said before, that Esther Moreno and Minami Toyota hadn't tagged together before, because they get each other so well, and all the spots they do together in tandem are so fluid. I think one of my favorite moments in it is actually right at the beginning, when Esther and Aja Kong have degenerated into this like crazy mess of limbs where they're just swinging at each other. And Minami jumps down off the turnbuckle and just quietly walks over to Bison and hops onto her and sunset flips her over and takes her down. Like, it's the period at the end of a sentence, and it's just freaking brilliant. Half of this match feels like dancing, because that's the thing that Minami and Esther bring to the table. Both of them is, you know, like, Esther has that lucha background, so she has like these beautiful arm drags and this smooth fluidness. And Minami is like the most lyrical wrestler ever, probably, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like, half of it is dancing and the other half is just pure viciousness. And Aja Kong is big and scary and mean in ways that are wonderful, but I noticed something in this match that I had never noticed before, which is all these little ways in which she takes care of her opponents, which is not really something she's known for, because you think of the people that get in the ring with her end up, you know, with a blood mask, which Esther Moreno does by the end of this, I think, because she gets hit in the face with a trash can.
Yes, she does. This was, I was kind of, there was a bit where she could have gone out and bladed, and she was definitely bleeding afterwards.
Yeah, I thought that too. So, I don't know. But there's a lot of blood everywhere by the end of the match. And the things I noticed that Aja did, you know, like when she gets Moreno up for a pile driver, when she brings her down, she makes sure that Moreno's head lands on her thighs, so it's nowhere near the floor.
Yeah.
And when she gets Minami's foot near the, or not her foot, her hand, I'm sorry, I'm under her foot, and she jumps to land, I was like, oh my God, she's going to break Minami Toyota's fingers. What is she going to do? And then she turns the jump into like a crossbody.
Yeah.
When she lands, so that Minami's hand, you know, has like, basically like, you know, doesn't have like a foot crashing down on top of it and doesn't break her hand. And Minami sells it so well that like, you know, it still looks devastating. But I don't think Aja Kong gets enough credit for how good she is at that. And I also don't think she gets enough credit in the sense that, like, there were not really that many bigger girls in wrestling in this time period for her to look up to and aspire to stylistically.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff she probably had to invent for herself. You know, like I think of women in wrestling now who are of a similar body type. Like I think of like Viper or what WWE is doing with Nia Jax. And those women have this stuff from this time period to look at, to, you know, immerse themselves in if they want cues for how to try to get that big monster character over without actually hurting your opponent so badly that no one wants to wrestle you ever again. And a lot of the women in this time period didn't have that luxury. They had to make it up for themselves, you know? I mean, like, I was really impressed by that in this match.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you, because Aja Kong is absolutely brilliant in this match. And you're right. I mean, there was Bull Nakano and Dump Matsumoto, but you can't do what Dump Matsumoto does because there's only one Dump Matsumoto.
Yep.
And if you try and copy her, you're going to look this close to her retirement, you're going to look slavish. So Aja had to start over. And, you know, you can see the development from her debut, where she's this afro-haired, swimsuit-wearing rookie, to getting a mohawk and going all very punk rock, and then putting weight on, and then putting muscle on and taking weight off. And this era is when she's just about, this era of Jungle Jack, they've just lost the big feud with Bull Nakano and Kyoki Inoue. They've both had their heads shaved. Bison Kimura has reinvented herself with that, quite frankly, ridiculous outfit. of gold lame cape with horns coming out the shoulder pads and a horned helmet. It's like a Greek god or Athenian god that she's trying to emulate. And Arge's kind of got into this, into what's her, become her classic look. The tights aren't there yet with the kick pads and the bagginess, but the top's certainly there. And she's got the Arge motif on her leotard. And you're starting to get to the where she's comfortable as Aja Kong. You know, this is the real Aja Kong. This is Jungle yes. Jack Aja Kong. This is all of her things. And Bison Kimura is so underrated as well. You know, in this
match, she's really good. She just doesn't get to do as much in this match.
No, she's kind of the glue that holds things together as well. I mean, also like the Omega Plex, which is Alpha Female's finisher. You know, and I need to talk to Jazzy about that because I realized
I saw that.
Yeah, and it's like you know, for someone like Alpha Female, Bison Kimura is kind of the blueprint for what you do because she isn't. She's big. She's a bulldozer of a wrestler, but she's tall and thick set. You know, like the modern equivalent is Alpha Female or Heidi Katrina, girls like that that are just big. They're not like huge like Aja Kong or Bull Nakano. They are big, stocky build wrestlers. And Kimura was kind of like on her own there too. I mean, there was Grizzly Uemoto and a couple of others who were like her. But, you know, as a heel, she kind of had to take this mix of a technical style plus a brawling style and develop that for herself. And she was an absolutely brilliant heel, and especially a very good cowardly heel as well, which was kind of unusual for AJW at the time. But in this, she had to keep up with Esther Marino and Manami Toyoa, and she was absolutely fantastic.
I really like when she went after Esther, and Manami's face is just like, oh no, none of this shit. And Manami just gets in there to rescue her partner. Like, it's so exciting.
Yeah, and Marino is so enthused and angry. She's a proper baby face. She's a technicos rather than a baby face. This is bringing a lot of Lucha Libre to this match, and it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. And the speed, the pace, the timing, everything flicks together so well, and everything fits. And it's such a great tag match because you don't really get tag matches like this anymore. Certainly not 50 minutes in the middle of the card. That would never wash in anywhere in wrestling in this day and age. So it was so refreshing to see. Because I haven't seen it for such a long time.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's a crazy match. And I think you can find it on YouTube if you want to look for just this match specifically. It's so much fun.
So it's Aja Kong and Bison Kimura versus Esther Marino and Manami Toyota. And then we move to the main event, which pits Bull Nakano against Monster Ripper. Now, Monster Ripper you might know better as Bertha Faye from her WWF run in the mid-1990s. But she'd been hanging around in All Japan Women on and off for about 10 years at this point. She made a debut in the late 1970s, stayed a while, stayed in the dojo. Didn't like it very much, but the Dynamite Kid actually persuaded her because she was from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and she had a lot of dungeon training. She was a dungeon graduate. She'd been trained by the Hart family. Dynamite said, you'd be okay, don't worry about it, keep trying. So she kept going back to All Japan, and she ended up being a main eventer. Now, this was well past her heyday, but Bull Nakano was the new sheriff in town. She was now the WWA heavyweight champion. She was having to represent the company. She was the face of the company, and a face despite her demeanor. And, you know, they went back and got all the old champions for really to put over Bull Nakano. Not that she needed the help, but it was very useful. And Monster Ripper in this was very, very good for a person that was probably at the end of her productive career before she went to WWE. And I really enjoyed this match for what it was. For 11 minutes and 7 seconds, this was two big wrestlers trying to wrestle each other rather than have a brawl. So it was a little bit awkward, but I like the awkwardness. What did you think, Chelsea?
The most awkward thing about this is that the match before it felt like the main event. So the crowd doesn't totally have enough left in them for the quality of this match. And they still maintain, they're still screaming, they're still cheering for all the big high spots, but it's just not as, if this match had preceded the one that came after it, I think that would have been a little more natural. It's good. And I like seeing two women who have a similar body type like that get into it, because you don't really see that.
Yeah, no, you don't. It's two big dogs.
Yeah, yeah. And it was cool seeing the transitions in how they moved each other around, because the fluid smooth stuff that the tiny girls get into is just not physically doable, but they're both so athletic that they find other ways to make it work. And it's interesting, they both wrestle like monsters, but also I felt like there was kind of a humanity to the way they treated each other that I'm not used to seeing in matches that have Bull Nakano in them.
No, normally Bull Nakano is get after it, destroy the opponent with move after move of sinister, oppressive horribleness. But this was a lot more back and forth. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, Monster Ripper was not a bad wrestler by any stretch of the imagination. And she was kind of like the big bad monster heel before Dump Matsumoto was the big bad monster heel. She was the top line heel in the 1980s. She'd won the WWA Women's Championship at this point. I'm pretty sure she had anyway. And, you know, she was coming back to do like this one-off event, really. And then she went on to the WWF as Bertha Faye, a completely different character. And just, it's worth mentioning her look, because, you know, that hair, the full Dalgleish, as I've said in the past, it's the classic example of 80s hair that is too big. I think you said, the bigger your hair, the closer you are to God.
Yes.
And I was slightly concerned with that top, though, because there didn't seem to be an awful lot of support going on there for the things she was trying to do.
No, it probably hurt a lot.
Yes, it was. It was interesting to see her look as well. You know, she prior to this, if you look at her earlier matches, it's kind of like more straight up black bad guy wrestler garb, whereas she's into the full face makeup as well with this. So she's trying the full intimidation tactics, and it works as a character. But then you've got Bull Nakano, who shouts her way through her promo. You know, she doesn't just talk to you. She assaults you with words. You know, and then she just, she's wearing like this blue glittered gown with a high collar that makes her look like Ming the Merciless as she strides purposefully down to the ring with this stern impression on her face. And it is just like, I own this place. I am the champion. I am the one that is going to lead this company to glory and die in the attempt. And that's all that pressure from the year she's had as being an AJW wrestler. And it's still like, you know, she's reached the absolute peak, but that's not enough. You've still got to keep going. You have to do more. You have to be better. You now have to be better than everybody else and lead them as well. There is an awful lot of pressure on this match just by her existence. But she always seems to enjoy herself when she's beating people up.
That's the thing that I think I really connect to about Bull Nakano, is that she is having a good time. She really loves it. And it's amazing that she was capable of holding up all that pressure, you know, under all that pressure, and still showing her joy for what she was doing.
Yeah, I completely agree. She's just that good as well. And like, you know, the matches, the moves that she did, she actually, because she tries to do a German suplex on Monster Ripper, but Ripper catches the top rope. So it stops her. But she's determined. So she has another go when she has them in the middle of the ring and just hurls her over her head. She doesn't really care where she lands, which is a bit unfortunate. It's not necessarily looking after your fellow person, but she holds her up in a bridge as well. You know, she was after doing wrestling maneuvers. She wasn't just after beating up Monster Ripper. But they go out in the crowd, and it's that four-way seating that they have in Japan. So you lift up one chair and you get four or five, and they start beating each other with them. You know, there was plenty of big person aesthetic in this match, but it was all in the violence of it. And Ripper does end up getting split, and I think she bladed because there was a point where she was kind of under the ring.
I think so too, because there's like a straight cut that you can see if you look really closely.
Yeah, which wouldn't have been a chair shot. It would have been a bit more random than that. And also Bull Nakano bleeds too, as well, which might actually have been a chair shot because it looked like a trickle. It wasn't like a... I don't think it was intentional, put it that way. There's a lot of blood on this card in general, really. It's violent, this card. If you are weak-hearted, I wouldn't. I'd go match by match and take yourself carefully through it. But this is good. Very, very, very good. But it is just quite violent. What do you think then of the overall place? Because you said earlier when we started this podcast, you were talking about how you think that the wrestlers have kind of got the idea of where they want to go. Whether the Matsumaga brothers want to go that way or not, you're not sure.
I don't know how to articulate it. It's just kind of the vibe that I got through the whole thing is that I feel like having seen some stuff that came before this and some stuff that came after this, I feel like I have a little bit of a sense of the direction of where the wrestlers are going. Like in particular, because probably some of this is just that there's so much written about Manami Toyota's career and her development. I feel like I have a sense of the trajectory of like where she goes stylistically from here. And I was thinking about like some of the stuff that she did in her match on this card that is just spectacular is not, it doesn't feel to me like it's properly appreciated for its level of specialness.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt about a lot of the stuff. I mean, you know, not just the wrestlers who we don't think of now who are really, really good, but there's a lot of stuff that happens on this card where it's just there's so much quality that the crowd doesn't totally react to all of it. And I feel like some of that may be that it just didn't have the full support of the higher ups as like, you know, okay, this is the thing we're pushing. This is the thing we want you all stylistically to do. This is the story we're telling. Some of it just felt like, well, the wrestlers stumbled upon this and it evolved naturally for them, but it wasn't the goal.
No, I think that's kind of like, I think that marries into what we were saying about like the 26 rule. With the 26 rule, you've got this new generation of wrestlers guaranteed every year.
Yep.
So you're going to, everything's going to push forward. It can't go backwards. There is no stopping it. The momentum is just continuous. Because next year's group are going to be better because the trainers of last year's group are going to be able to train better and they're going to wrestle better people when they get to the roster because the roster is better. So it has to get better. There is a point where it reaches a peak and that peak is around about 1995, I think, which was Nana Takahashi's graduation year. So, you know, I think it reaches that peak, but it's such a roller coaster to get you to that point as far as like the quality of your roster is concerned, because every year they take one step closer to greatness. And you know, if you say 1994 the Tokyo Dome is the crowning moment of All Japan Women, you know, there's a 26 year story to get you to that point.
Yeah.
And then
even if you look at wrestling Joshi now and you look at the wrestlers, some of the wrestlers who were trained by women who were a big deal in this era, it's really amazing.
Yeah, it is. And you can tell as well with their protégés. I mean, you look at Kagetsu, who's wrestling a lot for Stardom at the moment, but she's a Meiko Satomura protégé. You know, her style is very much, there is that, well, they did an entire feud based around it with Chigusa Nagayo. You know, Chigusa Nagayo, Kagetsu is kind of like where Chigusa Nagayo it would have been if she kept going. You know, that style is very much word of mouth and very much how you train people, like how you develop people. But that development has got on so much better because trainers are better now and there's more of them and they have different practices. And because the wrestling, most of the offices work together, they tend to talk to each other a lot about how you can get better with certain ways and certain ways of doing things. So there is certainly more variety in Joshi now because of the splintering of the offices. And you're starting to get Joshi back to where it was at this particular point. You know, Sendai Girls are doing really good business at the moment. So is Stardom. Stardom are doing business kind of like on streaming, but so is Oz Academy. You know, they're drawing big numbers again. And though you've got a splintered market, so I don't think it can be as big as this. You know, 5,000 seats are not a insane thing to think about now. Whereas even 5 years ago, that was probably like, ooh, that's a bit of a step off. We couldn't do that yet.
Yeah.
But I could see Sendai or Oz Academy doing a 5,000 seater and selling it out. It wouldn't be too much of a problem, I don't think. It's just
maybe they do one together.
Yeah, it's just how you put that card together. And that's a lot of it. I mean, it's like, you know, last year, Sendai girls were having big feuds with Seed Lightning, you know, so, and it was lots of interpromotional feuds week on week. Now they're working with, Reina, you know, Heidi Katrina spending a lot of time in Sendai girls. So it's, yeah, it's really interesting to see how that style that was really kind of reaching its peak creatively 25 years ago is still influencing and echoing what people do today.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yes. Right then, that pretty much wraps us up on this episode of the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling, where we've been looking at All Japan Wrestling from the 29th of April, 1991. You can find that card in many different places if you look around on the internet. You probably able to find it in DVD too, in a couple of places like Rudo Reels or IVP Video. Thank you very much for listening today. You can... kind of grand there. I'd say thank you very much for listening today, and thank you to my guest, Chelsea Spollen of Shoulders_Up on Twitter and at Chelsea Comics on Twitter as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me today. I appreciate that. You can listen to the other podcasts on the WrestleTalk Podcast Network. That's The Squash, which comes out Tuesday or Wednesday, kind of fortnightly, where they talk about the mainstream wrestling world, and Gavin Duenas and Ben Spindler will be joining you there this week. Thank you for listening to us. Please do subscribe to the YouTube channel, where you can find all the stuff that Ollie Davis and his friends put together for WrestleTalk. And we will speak to you next week. Bye.